back, session number 30633, Mr. James Farquharson, Reel 4. Now, we're talking about your time in the OTC. Can you, just to finish, can you tell me about the Cert A? What you remember, because you passed this. Now, you'd passed that, therefore, in 35 or 36, if you stopped.
Yes, in 36, I should say. Oh, there's that thing. Cert A, I'm afraid I have remarkably little detailed memory of. There must have been things like identification of targets and map reading, possibly. But I simply don't remember.
And you gave it up then. Now, why did you give it up?
I gave it up because I thought it was an appalling waste of time, and I knew there was never going to be any more war because the First World War was the war to end all wars.
And you believed that at the
time? I believed it, yes. And I knew very well that though there were rumblings in Germany, that this was far away and wouldn't affect us.
So you gave up when? 36?
Or 35? More likely to be 37, I think. That would give me 37 to 38 to 39. Yes, I think it was probably 37.
Now, can we talk about some of your other hobbies? One you mentioned was music.
Well, yes.
If we just talk about your hobbies generally, because, I mean, that's very important to a schoolboy, then.
Yes. Let me think. Difficult to remember. What hobbies I had when I arrived at the school, precious little, I think. But, at my prep school, my hobbies were things like butterfly collecting things to do with natural history and collecting fossils and so on. But that all, of course, faded away when I went to Harrow. There weren't any fossils there, as far as I know, except in the museum. And very quickly, as a result of my being a firelighter for one of the privs in my house, when I was still a fag, so that must be very early in my time there, he had a gramophone and a collection of records. And he came into the room while I was lighting his fire some occasion. I said, you've got a very interesting collection of records or something. He said, yes, well, if I'm not here any time you're doing my fire, put them on and play them. And it was a piece of Tchaikovsky, I think, was the first thing, the Fifth Symphony, played on about six sides of an old 78. And I got more and more interested in this, and I had learnt the piano, been taught the piano at my prep school by a poor old dear called Geraldine Sanford. And for a very strange reason, I asked to give up the piano. It was that she smelt. Rather embarrassing. I didn't know what it was, but in fact she was a secret smoker, which she tried to disguise with some kind of scent. And the odour was very strange. And so I was allowed to give up anyhow. When I got this fresh interest, I'd been interested incidentally in music in a small way for a very long time. I mean, my prep school, I sang in the school choir, and it was a very unmusical school, unfortunately. But the headmaster's son came back from university with a wind-up gramophone and played us an Elgar Pomp and Circumstance march. That absolutely thrilled me. And so I suppose before I went to Harrow, I'd already got a wind-up gramophone, a little Decca, I remember, and my mother gave me a set of records of Mozart's G minor symphony. That's the very first thing I ever heard. And before that, I'd been given some records of popular music of the First World War, I think. One was called The Vamp, and another was called Turkish Patrol. And I forget what else. There were all sort of semi-military tunes. Oh, and Tipperary and things like that. So I got a liking for music from the start. And then when I began seriously to play this man's music and take a much greater interest, I took lessons, piano lessons, from a boy who was slightly junior to me in the house, who was a very good pianist and was learning the piano. And at second hand, he passed on to me what he was taught.
Did you do music as a formal music lesson? Or did
yes. Then by the summer of... wait a minute. Yes, I took part, of course, in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, Trial by Jury, in my first year, sang in the chorus. And then took up the flute, which I was taught by the bandmaster, who was another retired soldier, Pa Wright, he was called, a jolly old boy, and I think he wasn't a very good teacher, but I made a start anyhow on the flute. And then our director of music left. He was knighted and made the chief of music at the BBC, with Adrian Bolt as his conductor under him, Sir Reginald Sparshot Thatcher, and was succeeded by one of the great inspirations of my life, a man called Henry Havergal, who had been director of music in his early 20s. He was made director of music at Fettes, Edinburgh, then moved on to school in Hertfordshire, Haileybury. And then came to Harrow. I think that was his next appointment, and was at Harrow for the rest of my career, and took a great interest in my keenness to play the flute. He, instead of having everything taught by one under music master, who was called Negus, and was terribly scatterbrained, did the most awful things, I remember, made muddles in church, playing the organ in chapel and things like that. He went, and Henry brought in his underling from Haileybury, a chap called Hector McCurrock, who succeeded him eventually at Harrow, and between them, they completely revolutionized the music of the school. They introduced a proper harmony church choir, instead of the school choir being the rug of 15 up in a gallery at the back, roughly speaking. And they also imported a whole lot of professional musicians to teach individual instruments. And I then was taught by a man called Charles Super, who was the ex-first flute in the London Symphony Orchestra, I think, and one of the main orchestras, dear old boy. And he really taught me all I knew about the flute. And I kept that up, playing the flute in the school orchestra and so on, and then in the Cambridge University Orchestra afterwards. And that was killed off by the war, and the fact that after the war I was living in lodgings, and flautists are not very popular in lodgings. So it all went by the board.
So but the flute was your main instrument?
The flute was my instrument. But I
would
also
you ran a music club as well, I think you said. Or
yes. Now, this man, Elliot Smith, I mentioned, who taught me modern language, taught me French, and was very eccentric, was also very musical. And he started gramophone recitals in the period before lunch on certain half holidays. And he handed over to me. And so I carried on. Heaven help the chaps who came to listen. There were quite a few of them came, because I gave a little talk about the piece that was to be played. I didn't know that I knew anything really worth saying, but that was all great fun. And I rapidly rose to be considered the top musical boy in the school, and even became unique by being elected to the Philathletic Club on the strength of music instead of football or cricket.
I'll come back to the Philathletic Club. Yes. I've got them in mind. Now, what about your other hobbies? Railways, you mentioned.
Railways, yes. Now, railways, I grew up with railways, really, because I was brought up in Weymouth, and there was a very interesting railway set up in Weymouth because of the port there. The boat trains came round to the pier, and the steamer came in and all that sort of thing. And even in a pram, I think my nanny would wheel me down there to watch the Jersey boat come in. And then there was all the extraordinary business of people loading up in the passenger carriages and being pulled by a little engine with a man carrying a flag in front, right round the quayside and so on. That all fascinated me. Then, at the age of 3, I was given my first Hornby train set. And so from then on, right up to the war, really, eventually, in association with my much younger brother, we built up a railway system and gave up gauge O at one stage, began again with gauge 00, which was half the size or quarter the size, and more scope, therefore, in a given space. And so we were doing that with model railways, and at the same time, I was taking an an increasing interest in railways, not only engine spotting, though I was very keen on that, but also taking great interest in the different classes of locomotive and even to some extent the rolling stock and so on. I knew nothing about signalling except what I saw when the signals went up and down, but I deduced quite a bit from that. And when I was old enough, say 10 or something like that, I would go from our house in Rodwell right down through the town in Weymouth to the railway station, go along Ranelagh Road, which ran alongside the railway, and came to a dead end where a footbridge went right across all the railway lines, which were still one of the sidings and things in the main line in the middle going out. And there I would spend hours on Alexandra Bridge, as we used to say in the railways, watching the working. And I even made myself known to an engine driver who worked a little branch railway line to Abbotsbury from Weymouth. And he always promised to take me on the footplate, but he never did, which was terribly disappointing. I went and stood beside him while he was waiting to leave, and he talked to me, and he said, next time. But it was always, you know, there was always an inspector in the offing or something like that, and so it never came off.
Did this carry through to school?
Yes, it carried through very much to school. Now, my headmaster's son, one Simon Corbett, who became a lifelong friend, was at university when I was a fairly senior boy in the prep school, so came home from the university term in June, and there was a long period while we were still at school, and I got very interested in, he was very keen on railways and was a member of the university railway club and so on, and had notebooks full of the numbers and names of all the engine classes and things like that, and I used to go and sit with him in his bedroom at the top of the house and copy out his notebooks, I remember, and very often making most awful misprints because his handwriting was not very easy to read. And we generally talked about things. He told me all sorts of things, which I lapped up about how railways ran and so on, and about famous names in the railway. And I read books, sort of general books about railways that were sort of suitable for schoolboys and so on.
Was there a hobbies club on railways, at the, you know, a railway modellers at the school?
At Harrow, yes. There were, this began in my first term, in fact. Now, Simon Corbett somehow, through a man called Derek Barry, D.S.M. Barry, who became the head of one of the railway regions and was a publicity man originally, wrote books on railways, and became a friend of his, I think through connections at Cambridge. He and Derek Barry happened to know a master at Harrow who was interested in railways or something, and so they made a connection with the school before I went there. So I was welcomed with open arms when I arrived as a budding recruit to the Railway Society. And there were two senior boys, Michael Cobb and James Collier Ferguson, who in other houses, but they took me in hand, and we talked a great deal. They knew much more than I did, taught me a lot about railways, and we were fortunate in having across the football fields and across the golf course, ran in this little stretch of open country, the Euston to Scotland main line. And I, whenever possible, got myself put down for Ecker Changed instead of having to play football. And so with them, who'd done the same thing, we trotted off down across the golf course and sat on the line side watching the trains. And it was a period when the LMS railway was being modernised after the rather belatedly after the First World War, when everything was run down. And so we saw, endlessly saw exciting expresses pulled by brand new super engines and that sort of thing, and kept careful records. We were really nothing much but train spotters at that stage. And that was all very exciting. I saw the Coronation Scot in 1937 doing the world speed record, with incidentally, Simon Corbett travelling in it. By that time, he was an apprentice in the railway. And he had warned me that at a certain time in the afternoon the train would be coming past on its way back to London. It was all very exciting. I went down and I took the best railway photograph I ever took in my life, I think, of that train by a most extraordinary lucky chance. It was published in the local newspaper and all sorts of things. The train was doing 96 miles an hour. And then, unfortunately, the interest in railways waned. And I by that time, become the secretary of the society. And it became more and more difficult to whip anybody up to go on outings. I arranged visits to engine sheds and things like that, which the railway companies were very happy to allow. And I remember an awful occasion when I had arranged a visit to Old Oak Common engine sheds on the Great Western, and nobody turned up to go. And I was naive in those days. I didn't know how to do anything about it. I just stood there and almost wept and thought, well, that's that. And I sort of gave up and went and had an ice cream or something, and got a furious letter a few days later saying that it was a very poor show, that nothing was said, nobody turned up, and an inspector had been paid to stay on the Saturday afternoon to guide us round. I was properly put in my place. It was the first of a string of life faux pas over my life, which I rather wish I could forget. So that then was transformed into a model railway club, and I ran that. And there was a little semi-derelict cottage right in the middle of the school, which we were allowed to use for our model railway. And there was a master called Swan, always known as White Man Swan for some reason, who really was... he had his own model railway, and he put it at our disposal. I mean, we set it up there, and then various boys had beautiful model engines and things they'd been given for Christmas presents, and they all brought them along. So we got quite a good system running. And that was the end of my railway interests at Harrow.
Now, what about the Boy Scouts? Because you were a Boy Scout as well.
Yes. Now, the Boy Scouts were... I'd been a Boy Scout, of course, and a Wolf Cub in my time. At my prep school, we had a Boy Scout troop. I was what's it called, a Sixer or something? The Kingfishers, I think. And we learnt to tie knots and then put... sew badges on our sleeves and things like that.
Now, how military were the Boy Scouts varying across the country and remembering their original foundations? Were yes. Either quite military or not at all? You know, I mean,
no, we were scarcely military. We wore a uniform, of course, a fairly complicated uniform with a scarf and a woggle and a large hat with finger holes punched in the top. I mean, you took it off like that. And otherwise, there was very little military about it. It was, what do you call it, woodcraft. I mean, more to do with hunting bears in the Canadian forests and things like that. On field day, we had our own field day, not military at all. We went somewhere and we crept through the undergrowth and things like that, and did everything possible not to give our position away. And that was enormous fun. I remember coming face to face with a small deer of some sort, which suddenly bobbed its head up about 3 feet in front of me. And it was a totally different world. I mean, much more civilized in a way. There was a parade. You call it that. We were all fairly senior boys. We all made fairly light of it. But we paraded on a meadow at the side of the school grounds. And I remember my responsibility was to roll the flag up. And I was the second head of the school then. And the head of the school, Peter Wilde, being the senior scout, had the privilege, after I'd rolled the thing and run it up on a rope to the top of the flagpole, he had the privilege of pulling the string to unfurl the flag. And I'm glad to say that I think it nearly always broke all right, and it didn't merely knot itself all the tighter, which just occasionally happened if I'd done it wrong. But there was an extremely pleasant master, Herbert Harris, who eventually took holy orders, who was the scoutmaster. And we did pleasant things. I really can't remember much what we did on parades. We learnt to tie knots.
Just like the usual stuff.
Yes.
But not military.
And we had a scout camp.
Well, what was that like?
Well, it was a trek. I only did that once, as far as I remember. And that was thoroughly enjoyable. We went by train, I suppose, out into the country to start our trek, somewhere in Wiltshire, I think. And we had a trek cart, and we trundled along pulling the trek cart with our gear on it, stopping at village pubs. Well, by that time we were allowed to drink, of course. I remember being taught by an old yokel how to throw a dart, playing darts in a pub in a place called Cern Abbas in Dorset. And we went. Our target was the Brotherhood of St. Francis at Batcombe in Dorset, a sort of Anglican, not nunnery, what's it, monastery, with brown brothers. And they were very much connected with the school. They used to come and preach in chapel sometimes, so there was a connection there. And this took 2 or 3 days of plodding along in, as far as I remember, perfect weather. And that was the sum total, really, of my experience as a scout.
Now, what about your climb up the hierarchy of the school? Which comes first? Is it the Phil Athletics Club, or is it...
Oh, it's happening.
So what I mean is, you know, which comes first? Or do you become head of your house or deputy? What's first?
You work your way up. We were very much... We were called Yearers. 1 Yearer, 2 Yearer, 3 Yearer. You became remarkably privileged. You were allowed to wear much easier, slacker clothes. Half holidays, you could wear a white scarf around your neck instead of a collar and tie. The school, I don't know, the school uniform, of course, included a terrific setup on Sundays when we wore black top hats, tail coats of a special design which were no use for going to a dance or anything.
This is just on Sunday you wore that?
That was on Sunday and on celebratory occasions, speech day, association day. There were 2 or 3 sort of festive occasions during the year.
So your parents had to buy this full outfit just for a few days, well, you know, for the Sunday and that?
For Sundays only, yes.
And it was a top. Did you like this outfit? I mean,
oh, God, sorry. And the hierarchy, yes. As we went up the school, so we got more and more privileges. And there was a great thing made of privileges of various kinds. And eventually, the top privilege in your house and in the schools, the privileges granted were 4 Yearer, which were all sorts of things like wearing a buttonhole and so on. I can't remember them.
You mentioned
all that.
Some other. Now, where did you join this Phil? Is it the Phil Athletics?
Phil Athletic Society, very much towards the end of my career.
Is it club or society? Because you said club before.
An athletic society, it was called, I think, yes.
And tell me exactly what this was and what membership of it meant. How did you get onto it? What did it mean?
Elected its members, who were presumably proposed by a member, and then either rejected or elected, and very much based on personal friendships, I think. And I forget how many members there were, but I should guess something like 15 altogether.
In each house? Or
No, the whole school. So this was nothing to do with houses at all.
Pretty restricted members.
It was right at the top of the sporting organisation of the school. The part that was not run by masters. The masters were sort of coaches, but the actual organisation was run very much by the boys, and the members of the Phil were absolutely the top of everything. They ran the cricket 11, the Rugger 15.
Now, you were elected because you were good at music.
I played the flute and played in the orchestra and did all sorts of other things in the musical world and somehow got a name for it. I can't imagine. It was an appalling surprise when they elected me. I didn't know what to do at first.
Now, what did it mean? Did you start wearing this strange... You said they wore a slightly effective...
Oh, this was only rarely on special... On Sundays, I suppose They were allowed to, yes, they were allowed to wear special waistcoats, that was it. I think that was about all ordinary, and of course a flower in their buttonhole. But on speech day and occasions like that, they would really broke out. I mean, they wore a special tie or a special scarf or something like that and made themselves look as absurd as they could.
Now, what did it mean for you being a member of it? I mean, what did it mean? What did you do?
It meant precious little to me, in fact. I think in the break in the morning, there was a break between about 11 o'clock, I think, a short break, a coffee break. And I was, by that time, I'd been a school monitor, of course, for quite a long time. I was a monitor for about 7 terms, I think, altogether. And in the War Memorial building in the school, there were 2 rooms on the opposite side of a corridor, the monitor's room on one side and the fill room on the other side. And monitors and members of the fill, and some were members of both, could go and have their morning coffee in one or other. And if you were a member of the fill, you tended to go into the fill room, because that was absolutely the...
And what was their room like?
Well, I go into it every now and again now, if I happen to go down to the school, and it's all pretty rough and ready, with the walls absolutely plastered with framed photographs of groups, every year going back into the Middle Ages, almost. And otherwise, some pretty tatty, easy chairs, and a table in the middle, perhaps, with chairs round to be occupied when there was a meeting.
What would the meetings be about? Or did you not take part much?
I don't think I took much part in that. I really can't remember.
Has the room changed a lot since your day?
The room? Very little, I should say.
I mean, obviously different photos, but the same kind of...
Same idea, yes, yes.
Now, what about being a monitor? I know it comes beforehand, but what does it mean, being a monitor?
Now, being a monitor, to begin with, your housemaster would appoint his chosen boys to be privs, which are, some houses call them house monitors, whose authority was purely within the house. And there was the head of the house, of course. And the head of the house was always also a school monitor. School monitors were appointed by the headmaster, and the housemaster could put boys forward to the headmaster. And the thing, one grievance we had was that my housemaster, who was very modest, said that he didn't see that any house was entitled to more than one monitor. There were some houses that had 4 monitors. And eventually, there was a breakthrough in my last 2 years when he suddenly realized how he was doing his house down. And so I became a monitor. Let me think. A monitor on one term at the end of an academic year. I was then a school monitor for the whole of the next year, which was 37 to 38. And then for 38 to 39, I was assistant head of the school.
Now, what did it mean being... we'll go through a house monitor, then a school monitor. What did it mean you had to do?
The principal thing you did... well, as a house monitor, it was really a privileged position. There was nothing very much that you had to do of any use, as far as I remember. When you were a school monitor, the principal thing that you did was to read the lesson in chapel.
So it wasn't a disciplinary thing? School monitor.
It's difficult to tell, because everybody was so well disciplined that nothing much ever happened, you see. I can't remember what the authority was granted to monitors particularly, but certainly in the course of each term, every monitor read a lesson in chapel, and there was 2 Sunday services, and 2 monitors each Sunday. First lesson, second lesson, head of the school, second head of the school, say, and then in the evening the other way round.
Now, then, one thing I should have asked you about was, which house were you in? It's foolish of me not to...
My house was called the Knoll, K-N-O-L-L.
K-N-O-L-L,
yes. Founded in about the 1860s, in the days when the houses were all privately owned, of course, by the housemasters.